Haiti's gangs want a government seat. South Florida charter schools want more public school cash. And Floridians may now want to go to Latin America for abortions. Welcome to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll update you on the worsening crisis in Haiti, powerful gangs making a violent bid for political clout, political bosses holding up a new transitional government, the deeper suffering of Haitians themselves. We'll also look at the legal battle raging in Broward County over how much money public schools are required to give charter schools. And we'll examine whether Florida's strict new abortion law may steer women here toward Latin America. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to this special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or on WLRN.org. We're going to start today in a place that needs our attention more than ever, Haiti. I know we keep asking, could the situation there get any worse? And then it does. But this week felt especially urgent because the violent gangs that control much of Haiti got a lot more explicit about demanding a driver's seat in Haiti's government, as if bizarrely underscoring that agenda. In addition to terrorizing Haitian neighborhoods, they burned and looted public institutions like the National Library in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Meanwhile, Haiti's power vacuum drags on because the political elite keeps delaying legal authorization for a new transitional governing council that's supposed to lead the country back to stability and desperately needed new elections. But most of all, the suffering of ordinary Haitians only deepens as the chaos cuts them off from food, water, fuel, and medical care, with little hope of escaping their nightmare anytime soon. Joining me now is without a doubt the best journalist covering the Haiti crisis, Jacqueline Charles from our news partner, the Miami Herald. Jackie, thanks as always for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with a helpful crisis update article you published yesterday. You reminded people that Haiti's main airport, Toussaint-L'Ouverture, and its main seaport, both in Port-au-Prince, have now been shut down for more than a month. The airport at Cap-Haïtien on the north coast is still operating to a certain extent, but did you ever expect to see Toussaint-L'Ouverture closed for this long? And what does that say about just how severe this crisis is?
Well, it definitely says that this crisis is severe, not just because of the violence, but also the economic impact that we're going to see. Because what this means is that the government isn't getting any revenue in. At the same time, the real impact is the fact that Haitians can't get medications, they can't get food. Whatever they have is what's there in the country. And we really don't know when either the seaport or the airport will return to normal operations.
All right. But just as important, you remind folks that this transitional governing council called the Transitional Presidential Council, which was just assembled last week, is also being stalled in no small part by politicians who are questioning its constitutionality. In your opinion, Jackie, does this new solution to ending the chaos in Haiti have any more chance of succeeding than, say, outgoing interim Prime Minister Ariel Henry had of succeeding?
Look, this is a very complicated situation. I mean, there's so many issues and layers. It's not just about the legality of this, because we aren't in the Constitution. But, you know, as you know, with Haiti, there's always backroom wheeling and dealing that's going on. And so you have people that are also trying to put in some sort of a stopgate measures to ensure that it will succeed and doesn't fail. Because if it fails, what is the plan B? We're hearing people talk about, you know, the Constitution or the Supreme Court. Well, that's it. You know, that isn't really legally an option either. I mean, the reality is that we have a 3-alarm fire, and this is not moving as quickly as a lot of people thought or imagined. Again, the crisis didn't start 3 years ago. Yeah. It has been brewing for at least a decade. And I think it's going to be time. And I don't know that if tomorrow you install this council, the violence goes away.
No, not by any means. I would agree. But how worried along those lines should we be about this demand by the gangs that they be given a voice and even a seat in this transitional government process? They want this really shady character, Guy Philippe, for example, to represent them. Unless some force steps in to neutralize the gangs, are Haiti and the international community going to have to consider negotiating with these guys to let the country move out of this nightmare?
I have to tell you, there is a real concern, and it's not just among the people there, but Haitians are not interested in having this conversation. They don't see a seat. They don't want a seat. But what we are seeing, though, is that outside of Haiti, we've heard the words of a former U.S. ambassador, Pamela White. I know that in the Caribbean community that there are leaders saying that Haitians should negotiate with some of these gangs. But how do you negotiate with 300 different gangs?
Yeah.
I think that people have a tendency to oversimplify the situation in Haiti. And what you do have that's happening in the country today is that Haitians aren't looking at the crisis that's right before their eyes, but they're also looking down the road.
Sure.
And I think the fear is that this is going to be a problem.
And was that question even made even more urgent this week when the gang started destroying much of Haiti's national history, the National Library, archives? What do you think was their reason, if there was one, for doing that? It almost reminded me of ISIS and the Taliban destroying precious history artifacts in the Middle East, for example.
I have seen no indication that Haitians that are involved in these political discussions are prepared to pull out a seat for either Guy Philippe or any of the gang leaders that are part of this alliance. What I've been hearing from Haitians is, what is it that these gang members want?
Yeah.
Because they are destroying not just public entities, but they're destroying hospitals, schools, you know, in their neighborhoods. And so, you know, how do you rebuild after all of this? And so that's the question. What is it that they really, truly want?
Yeah. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles about this week's deepening crisis in Haiti. And Jackie, this, of course, brings us to the question of what the heck happened to this plan to have 1,000 Kenyan police officers lead a multinational security assistance mission into Haiti? As you note in your article, not much has been heard from Kenya lately.
Exactly. And it's still on hold. And the reality is that there's only $10 million in the pot that the UN has. And Republicans in Congress are still blocking the Biden administration's request for $40 million of the $200 million that they promised.
Right. Jacqueline, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. As always, we appreciate your insights. Jacqueline Charles covers Haiti for the Miami Herald. Jackie, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, Florida says Broward County's public schools owe its charter schools a lot of money. Is that fair? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. 6 years ago, voters in Broward County approved a tax referendum that raised millions of new dollars for their public schools. Afterward, court cases and a new state law required Florida's public school districts to share revenue with charter schools, which are funded by taxpayer dollars but are run by private organizations. As a result, charter schools in Broward are suing for some of that tax referendum cash, $80 million of it. And the state of Florida is backing them, arguing that until Broward Public Schools District pays the charter schools, it's, quote, not in compliance with state law. The district says its budget is stretched as it is, but the state says it's got until April 17th to pony up or face sanctions that could include the withholding of state funds. In the middle of all this, not surprisingly, is Florida's Republican Education Commissioner, Manny Diaz, a champion of and prodigious recipient of political donations from charter schools. With me now to wade through this legal swamp is WLRN education reporter Kate Payne. Kate, how are you?
I'm good.
Let's first follow the money here. How did these Broward County charter schools, almost 90 of them, right, arrive at this $80 million figure they want the Broward Public Schools District to cough up?
Yeah, so that dollar amount came from basically the proportion of charter school students within Broward County mm-hmm. as a whole of, you know, all the students in Broward County.
Okay. So it's a proportional thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, let's remind people that this Broward County tax referendum was carried out before Florida passed a law mandating that public school districts share revenue with charter schools and before the charter school started suing for the money. So help us understand the chronology of all this and whether the Broward County Public Schools can argue that it raised this tax money before the law required them to share it, and therefore the state is perhaps trying to apply something retroactively?
Yeah, so as far as the timeline, again, this deals with a tax referendum that voters approved back in 2018,
right.
And that was to last for a four-year period. So the actual money raising, you know, was from July 2019 through the end of June 2023. And that was money raised for teacher pay, for school safety, for other programs. And it was, you know, specifically for district schools, that is to say traditional public schools. There was a small carve out for security efforts for charter schools. So charter mm-hmm. schools did get a small amount of this money. So again, this was passed in 2018. The lawsuits brought by charter schools in Broward County did not come until October 2023.
Okay.
So at no point, you know, when the referendum was going to the ballot in 2018, during the actual run of the four-year, you know, timeline of the referendum, no lawsuits were filed in Broward
right. so
County.
So there is some issue of retroactivity at play here then.
And that's what the Broward District has said is, this money was spent, it was allocated, and it is gone. This
yeah.
money is no longer in possession of the Broward School Board.
So then what's the charter school argument here, both micro and macro? Why are they claiming they're owed this money under a state law that was passed essentially after that money was raised and allocated?
Yeah, so there have been other court cases dealing with similar disputes in other counties that arguably do apply to Broward County. And more broadly, stepping back, in Florida, charter schools are public schools.
Yeah.
And the legislature has established charter schools should be funded as other public schools.
Right.
So that's sort of the brunt of the argument.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we need to discuss the strong support the charter schools are getting in this case from the state itself, largely in the person of Education Commissioner Manny Diaz. He is a major champion of charter schools. Tell us more about that and about the charter schools involved in this battle that have apparently funded his political campaigns in the past.
Yeah, there are connections there. Manny Diaz, you know, has had a long career in education, first, you know, spending 2 decades in Miami-Dade public schools mm-hmm. before moving into the state legislature and then into the charter school arena. You know, a statement from the Department of Ed, they have said, you know, he's an ardent advocate for students, irrespective of the educational options they choose. But he does have these longstanding relationships with charter school advocates and the charter school space in the state. He was a top official for Doral College, which is a private college affiliated with one of the big charter networks, where basically charter students could take dual enrollment classes mm-hmm. at Doral. And throughout his political career as an elected official, he was raising campaign donations from charter school organizations, charter school executives, directly to himself and also through a political committee that he chaired.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those repeat donors is a group called Charter Schools USA, which is a national management company that runs charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so repeatedly, Charter Schools USA was giving maximum donations to Diaz, you know, the maximum allowable under state law. And up to the most recent I found was a $25,000 contribution to Diaz's political committee, Better Florida Education. And that came actually a month exactly after Governor Ron DeSantis tapped Diaz to be the next
right.
Commissioner of Education.
But on the Broward County Public School side of things, what's
mm-hmm.
their main argument then? Why do they claim they don't by law owe the charter schools at least this amount of money that the charter schools are asking for.
Yeah, so again, for them, it's this argument that when voters approved this measure in 2018, the language on the ballot specified that, you know, the small amount of money would go to security operations in charter schools, but otherwise this money was set aside for district schools, for traditional public schools. And during the run of the referendum, during those 4 years, no lawsuit was brought. It wasn't challenged.
And the referendum language explicitly excluded charter schools then in that context that you're talking about.
That was the intention. And now there is an additional referendum passed by Broward voters in 2022, which did explicitly include charter schools. And those funds are actively being shared.
And the Broward County District Attorneys are also arguing that the state essentially needs to butt out of this while the charter school lawsuits process plays out.
Yeah, so to spell that out, you know, these lawsuits are playing out, lawsuits brought by these charter schools against the Broward School Board. Those are playing out, you know, they're approaching settlement proceedings. But at the same time, Commissioner Manny Diaz, you know, beginning last month, began investigating the Broward School Board over this issue, brought his findings to the State Board of Education and said, you know, Commissioner Diaz has determined that the board is out of compliance with state law, and that the state board can consider sanctions, regardless of these lawsuits that are actively playing out.
Yeah, and let's get to that. First, this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with education reporter Kate Payne about the legal battle between Broward County's public and charter schools over millions of taxpayer dollars. So let's get to that issue, Kate. What happens if the Broward Public Schools refuse to pay this $80 million to the charter schools? The state says it has until April 17th to pay up, and if it doesn't, the district faces sanctions, right?
Yeah, and so I will say, you know, the Broward Board, their stance has been they are addressing these lawsuits. They are in good faith answering, you know, to the disputes of the charter schools in, you know, through the court process. They, last I heard, they're scheduled to have a mediation with charter schools next week on April 10th in a good faith effort to, you know, work through this issue. But it is a question of, can the district, you know, effectively negotiate dozens of different contracts, different payouts with charter schools in such an expedited timeline?
Right, because it seems like the state is saying, well, the lawsuits are moot, really, because we're saying that you have to follow state law. So it's like, it's almost as if the lawsuits don't matter then, right?
That's,
you know, least in the state's mind.
And that's part of the argument that district attorneys have made, is that it's sort of a separation of powers issue. Of they're arguing that the state board, an extension of the executive branch of the government, is overstepping the right of and the responsibility of the courts, the judicial system, to address these ongoing disputes.
So when can we expect the district to make a decision about whether it's going to comply with the state's demands to pay these charter schools this money or not?
Yeah, well, and again, the board has said they are, you know, moving forward with this in good faith. They're scheduled to meet with the, you know, representatives are scheduled to meet with the charter schools on the 10th to try and mediate agreements. And then the Broward School Board is scheduled to have a full meeting again on the 16th, and they'll get a status update. And then the state board will meet the next day on the 17th.
And one of the other Broward County Public Schools arguments is, look, if we have to shell out $80 million, that's going to be a really severe hit to our budget, right?
Absolutely. And they've said, you know, in legal filings that, you know, an unforeseen expenditure like this would carry dire consequences for the district, that they don't have this kind of money laying around.
Right. Particularly for a district that's losing enrollment.
That's losing enrollment.
Broward County is.
Yeah. And actively considering larger plans to seriously cut spending through potentially closing a number of schools, potentially selling or leasing campuses. So they're already facing really tough challenges economically.
And now we have another similar situation playing out right now just to the north in Palm Beach County, right? But it turns out the public school district there is not fighting this.
Well, so the Palm Beach situation is a little different in that charter schools did sue Palm Beach during the run of that 2018 referendum. So while it was actively, The money was being raised and paid out.
So Palm Beach couldn't make that retroactivity argument the way that, But either way, Kate, in just the last minute or so we have here, let's talk about the larger education here issue here. As we mentioned, charter schools are publicly taxpayer funded, but privately run. Do public schools like Broward see this fight as important in the larger sense that they feel that they have to draw a line on what many see as an attempt by conservatives to chip away at public education and replace it with private channels like privately run charter schools?
I mean, that's absolutely the concern here for Broward and for those public school advocates, is it's another way that what they see as sorely needed public funding for public schools being diverted to schools that don't have the same oversight, don't have the same state mandates to meet regulations.
And those fears exacerbated by the fact that last year Florida passed a law that gives private school vouchers to any family, regardless of income. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, but this will play out for the rest of the month then, obviously, this battle.
Okay. Yes, we'll see more.
Kate Payne covers education for WLRN. Kate, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, could Latin America become Florida's abortion refuge? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome back to a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. You can make your donation to continue to support programs like this by calling 866-247-9576 or at WLRN.org. This week, Florida's Supreme Court ruled 6-1 to uphold Florida's new 15-week abortion ban. That decision automatically upholds the state's even newer and even stricter 6-week ban. That law will now take effect on May 2nd. Up to now, women seeking abortions across the U.S. South had looked to Florida as a refuge from the restrictive laws in their own states. Now the question is, where do women in Florida go if they're seeking an abortion after the 6th week of pregnancy? The answer may be even farther south, in Latin America, where in the past few years, countries like Colombia, Mexico, and Argentina have legalized abortion. Colombia, in fact, now allows the procedure up to the 24th week of pregnancy, which until now had been Florida's limit. So, since Florida is so relatively close to Latin America, and since so many women here are so familiar with the region, will it become an option for them? Joining me now to discuss that possibility is Daniela Martins. She's an expert on women's reproductive health issues based here in Miami, and she has worked extensively in Latin America. Daniela, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me again, Tim.
Let's first give people an appreciation of the irony involved here. Remind us how dependent women in Latin America once were on Miami as a place to seek abortion services because the laws in their countries were so draconian.
That's completely right. So we're seeing a complete role reversal now. When once folks were looking to the United States as the place to be able to access reproductive care in one of the most conservative regions, women were flying to the United States for abortion care, and also there were collectives working on this side of the border to receive women needing abortion care from the bordering states. And now what we're seeing is a total reversal. We're seeing in the Texas border more and more women going into Mexico.
And so also remind us, Daniela, how that started changing then in recent years, remarkably quickly, as it turns out, starting with Argentina and a movement known as the Marea Verde, or Green Wave, right?
So in December of 2020, the Green Wave is able to effectively decriminalize abortion in Argentina.
Right.
After that, Colombia and Mexico follow suit. There's also smaller decriminalizations and opening of exceptions in other countries in the region. As the region turns green with this green wave movement to decriminalize abortion rights, at the same time, we see the fall of Roe in the United States. And so, what once was one of the most conservative regions when it came to access to reproductive care is now one of the most progressive ones. And now in Florida, we're actually seeing this 6-week ban that makes Florida more restrictive than most of the largest countries in Latin America today.
And I should point out that in these Latin American countries like Colombia, Argentina, and Mexico, it's been sort of a combination of either Supreme Court rulings or legislative decisions, right? It's been a mix of both.
Correct. In Argentina, it was a decision, it was a bill that passed decriminalizing abortion, and both in Mexico and in Colombia, it was Supreme Court decisions.
Right. Now, as we pointed out, it's legalized in Colombia, but we're still waiting to see how it plays out in states, the totality of states in Mexico, right?
So it depends on the states. Each state has a different legislation, but multiple states in Mexico already have fully decriminalized abortion up until a different amount of weeks. The vast majority of them who already have a certain degree of decriminalization are more progressive right now, and women have more rights and more freedoms than in Florida as of May 1st.
And in Argentina, update me, please. Am I hearing that new President Javier Milei, very conservative new president, may try to repeal the legislation that decriminalized abortion there?
We always hear these voices of dissent and these issues being used politically, but as we're seeing in the United States, this is a very popular issue with people. People want folks to be able to have access to essential care. And in Argentina, they don't have the votes, even though there is noise.
Right. Now, and as we pointed out in Colombia, we have a 24-week limit, but we should also point out that in Mexico and Argentina, the limit is about half that, 12 weeks, right?
13
So,
in
okay.
Argentina, and in Mexico, it depends on the
Depends
state.
on the states. Can you tell me what more or less is the range of limits in Mexico that we're seeing?
Without any exceptions, it's around as well 14 weeks.
Okay.
And then with exceptions, it goes a lot higher. So exceptions are, rape, incest, and fetal malformations are very critical situations that endanger life and health.
Now, I know we're also seeing robust legalization movements in countries like Chile, for example. Where do things stand right now across the region in terms of nascent movements going on with this Marea Verde process?
I would actually put my eyes on Brazil.
Brazil, okay.
There is a case before the court, and there has been a very strong movement on the ground making the demands, mobilized partially by certain horrific atrocities and certain cases that have happened that have moved people.
Right.
Tremendously. As it happens, when these tragedies become real and when they become so clear, as my fear is will happen in Florida soon, as the 6-week ban is enacted, people start seeing the actual human consequences of these bills
Well,
and they start mobilizing against them.
let's talk about Florida. Up until now, women here in the state have been able to avail themselves of the state's 24-week abortion limit because the 15 and now 6-week bans were still playing out in court. That has all ended now, or at least until we see whether Florida voters approve a state constitution amendment proposal in November that would restore that 24-week limit. So now that this very strict 6-week law will be in effect in Florida as of next month, Daniela, are you expecting more women here to start looking to countries in Latin America for abortion services?
So Florida is a very large state. And as of right now, as you mentioned at the beginning, Florida was also receiving a lot of people from the southeast. And we foresee that folks are still going to continue to try to travel as far as Illinois, Maryland, New York, or DC from the say the more northern sides of
Right.
Florida. However, in the south of Florida, we have something unique because we do have a population in South Florida that has a Latin American connection and that has cultural roots and that has family members and that has the language. And so it is very likely that we will see folks that do have that connection with Latin America now start to travel to countries like Colombia or like Mexico or like Argentina for
Right.
abortions.
Now let's get to that. First, though, this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Daniela Martins, an expert on women's reproductive health issues, about whether Florida's new abortion law may steer women here toward Latin America. So let's go back to those countries in Latin America that we're talking about, Daniela. Would it be fair to say that Colombia is probably the most logical destination for women here, particularly in South Florida, given not only that it has legalized a 24-week limit for abortion services, but also that it's the relatively closest option here in terms of flights and things of that nature?
That's right. There's also in South Florida a Colombian population that maintains roots and that maintains a connection to its home country. So it would be natural to start to see those patterns. We also already have seen this happen with other types of medical care, right? Medical care that is cheaper than in the US because the US healthcare has so many holes of coverage. We've already seen folks go to their countries of origin or countries where they have family members for certain types of medical care. So we could only assume that this would be another of the reasons why people would be going to Colombia, but folks might choose Mexico if they
Right.
have their personal connections there, right?
But if so, what can we then expect to see here in Florida, especially South Florida, in terms of efforts to help women locate abortion clinics in countries like Colombia and help them pay for transportation? You mentioned earlier an interesting point that in the old days when women in Latin America were coming to seek abortion services in Miami, there were, as you called it, collectives here to help them in that effort. Are we going to see perhaps efforts here to help women in South Florida or Florida go to places like Colombia for abortion services?
So it has been something very beautiful to see how the green wave has made its way from Latin America to the United States after the fall of Roe. There's been increasing solidarity and these open arms. And as I see the green handkerchiefs pop up in all places in the United States, especially in Florida, this is the green handkerchief being the symbol of the green wave in Latin America. It is only natural to see how these natural networks of solidarity and of companionship are starting to form. And services typically follow suit those networks of solidarity.
So
I think
there will be an effort to help lower income women than you think, say, get a flight to Bogota or Cartagena or Buenos Aires if they need abortion services after the 6 week of pregnancy.
that continues to be always the question, right? Traveling will always be a privilege. Those who can afford traveling out of state or out of the country will be able to access safe abortion care. But the brunt of this bill will continue to be suffered by folks who already struggle to pay their bills and keep their lights on right now. Will there be efforts like the ones that you mentioned? I really hope so. But the immediate reality is that there aren't any specific efforts that we know of right now, and the brunt is going to be suffered immediately.
Now, Danielle, in the minute we have left here, one last question. Do you worry, though, in turn, that we might see conservative Florida legislators try to somehow block women here from traveling to Latin America for abortions, the way we've seen conservative states like Missouri, for example, try to penalize women for traveling to other U.S. states for abortions by, for example, allowing people to sue anyone they think helped a woman travel to those places?
I wouldn't put any efforts past them. What we have seen is conservative legislators go as far as they possibly can to prevent women from accessing the freedom of their reproductive care and their freedom to choose when and how to have families. However, in November, there's going to be a ballot initiative, Amendment
Right.
4. And with Amendment 4, my hope is to see that the government interfering can be stopped
Okay.
once for all in Florida.
Well, we'll see how that plays out. Daniela Martins is a Miami-based expert on women's reproductive health issues who has worked extensively in Latin America. Daniela, many thanks.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Helen Aceveda with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN Public Media.